Good morning again. If you were here last week, if you were here last week, you heard that we're in, starting last week, leading up to next week, which is Commitment Sunday. And that's a time of year where we think about what we might give to God through our work here at Christ Lutheran. That, of course, includes things like certain skills and talents that you may have, time that you may be able to give, and everyone's favorite topic, finances. And my original goal was to frame that in terms of the ways that God shapes us. One of those being how we use our resources. Not just our finances, but again, our time and our skills, talents, and things like that. Because those are ways that God changes our heart, softens our hearts, molds it a little bit each time. That definitely includes what we do with our money. I mean, money is a big deal. It's important. And the way that we use it and what we give it to can change our hearts. And if that doesn't make sense, imagine someone, I don't know, the standard Scrooge character who is very, very tight with the money and refuses to be generous. Well, when that person learns to maybe give a little, it evokes a certain kind of change within their hearts. And Jesus himself said, wherever your treasure is, that's where your heart is too. And so it's important not just because we need to keep the lights on, but also because it allows us or gives us an opportunity to think about our own hearts and where they are at. Now, into next week, Commitment Sunday, you should receive something in the mail that has a form in it that invites you to pray and consider what God may be asking of you. In the holistic sense, whether your time and skills as well as finances. And this is an opportunity to sit with God. I encourage you to spend some time, pray about it, think about kind of where you're at and how much you might be able to give over this next year. And again, all of the normal disclaimers apply. This is not a fundraising campaign, capital campaign. This is just normal giving. This is not binding in any way. No one's going to come after you. No one's keeping track that you're, you know, keeping up with whatever you wrote down. Although if you exceed it, thank you. That said, a single person, Tom Hebblewhite, will access this information one time, and then he hasn't corrected me, so I assume it's right. I think it goes into a box and tucked away in his garage or something like that. In other words, I'm not going to see it. Nobody's going to keep track or anything like that. This is mainly between you and God. It will be accessed once, one, so that people who might need to know who is interested in serving in different ways can reach out. And then also to do some calculations, you know, adding everything up, just so we get a picture of what the next year looks like. If you have any questions about any of that, please talk to me or one of your lay ministers. Now, with that all aside, and with the idea that God shapes us through prayer and through giving, whatever that may look like, that raises the question, giving to what? And last week, if you were here, I kind of felt the need to shift gears. This is when conflict especially started breaking out in Iran. And frankly, it feels like the world is still on fire. And it is full of all kinds of uncertainty. And now is not a great time to be on social media because everyone has opinions. And just by sheer probability, everybody is wrong, I think. And nobody has all the information. And so as we kind of talked through our text, the question bubbled up to the top, like, what do we do? What do we do when the world feels like it's on fire And we ended with, we love our neighbor. We love our neighbor. That's what Jesus has called us to do. That's what we as followers of Jesus have done for our 2,000 year history. And really, it's just by loving our neighbor that we have quite literally changed the world. And so we should probably keep doing that. So what I want to do is take more time and look at that. Now, next week, we will have like a video that I'm putting together of all the different board, or most of the different board chairs. If I haven't heard from you, please reach out to me. I will try to reach out to you so that we have everyone represented. Just to talk a little bit about what they do and what's happening here at Christ Lutheran. Because if the whole point of what we do here as a church is to create a fence that around us that allows us to feel safe, then we've absolutely failed. The goal is to tear down whatever barriers that might exist, whether natural or constructed, that keep us from interacting with the world around us, and more specifically, our community. That's our goal. Because if we really believe what we believe about who Jesus is and what he has done for us, why wouldn't we want to reach out? And there are some great things happening, very encouraging things. If you were at the 40th annual Chili Cook-Off and Talent Show, you would have been shocked. There were approximately 120 people there. I don't know if that's a record, but it's certainly more than I've ever seen. And estimating around 50 people were from the school. That's huge. That is absolutely a record. Thank you to Elizabeth, who I think just went around and bothered people and said, hey, talents, share them. That's the kind of thing we want to see. Because that opens up opportunities to engage and form relationships in the name of Jesus. So now we turn to our gospel reading. The woman at the well. It's a very famous, and because it's famous, very often misunderstood, interaction that Jesus has. He's traveling through, he's traveling south from Galilee to Judea, it seems. And they're in Samaritan country. If you were a good Jewish person, you would actually hop across the Jordan River, most likely, and travel on the other side so you could avoid Samaritans. Because Jewish people and Samaritans hated each other to the point of violence. And I think it's important to point out that there are no good guys in that story. Both sides were just terrible to each other. I know that's unique to the Middle East, and that's not how that happens now. But that's how it was. And so Jesus, as the story goes, sitting at a well, and there is a woman that approaches. And Jesus is alone. It would be considered kind of improper for a man to be alone with a woman like that. This is a very traditional culture. And the fact that she is a woman puts her as kind of a second-class citizen. That's how it was back then. I'm not saying it's right. Don't shoot the messenger. But the fact that she was also a Samaritan, and we're talking in a Jewish context, means that she is about the lowest status you can get. And Samaritans had similar beliefs, and they have a long, complicated history with Judea or Judah, as well as, and Israel in general, that we do not have time to go into. Jesus, however, has this funny and, depending on who you were, irritating habit of caring absolutely nothing about a person's status. He does not respect human status whatsoever. And so he asked this woman, can I have a drink? He's not supposed to be near her, let alone talk to her. And she, of course, brings that up. So Like, why would you talk to me? You're a Jewish man. I'm a Samaritan woman. We hate each other, I think. Are we supposed to? Because I'm not sure what's going on here. And that's exactly the kind of barrier tearing down that makes Jesus so incredibly mysterious in a way. Hard to pin down, hard to describe. And I pray that that can be said about us too. Now, she says, why would you? This doesn't make any sense. And then he says, well, if you knew who was asking you, you would ask him for water. And at some point in that conversation, we have to ask the question, are we still talking about water? Because she's talking about water. He was talking about water. And now he's talking about something different. Like there would be like this living water, which is water that flows, water that has a source that it comes out of, rather than like stagnant water. But he seems to be talking about something different. Now, if we were kind of doing a one-shot through the entire book of John, we would probably already start seeing some connections. Because last week, as Jesus was interacting with his new disciple, Nicodemus, who does become his disciple, Jesus says that if you want to be a part of what God is doing on earth, you must be born of the water and the Spirit, which, as we again said last week, is a very special Greek construction of words that John likes to use. It means water, which is the Spirit. It's a way of saying that they're the same. Kind of a reference to baptism. And so now we're talking about water again. And as good, you know, readers and people tracking with the story, we would say, okay, at some point this conversation is absolutely not about water, but I don't know where this is going. And so, and neither does she, as it were. So they start going back and forth, and now the conversation is clearly not about water, and Jesus does the most, like, rabbi thing to do. He says, go call your husband. He knows. And now she knows that he knows. And this is not the only time where Jesus will say something kind of obtuse in order to draw something out. My favorite example is when a blind man approaches Jesus and then Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? What do you think? But he has deeper reasons for asking these questions or saying these things. And what he's doing is drawing something out and of this woman. And we're about to learn that she's had a hard life. But she says, I'm not married. And now Jesus says, well, you're right. You've been married 5 times. And now the person you're with is not your husband. Now, this is where I every single time this comes up, I just feel compelled to mention it. This poor woman has been abused by preachers for generations. She's a woman in first century Samaria. She does not have the rights or agencies to divorce. She does not have the right or agency to even choose who her husband is. She's a victim here. Whatever else is going on, the vast majority of what Jesus just explained happened to her. Now, does that mean she's perfectly innocent? No, she's human, so no. But what people have for a very long time made all kinds of wild speculations about her personality and her character and things like that, and all of it is baseless. This should be seen as a situation that happened to her, not a woman who's made a bunch of horrific mistakes. But that culture being what it is, she'll still bear the guilt of that, which is deeply unfortunate. And Jesus shows up to bring healing. So, if we're keeping track, within that culture and from that perspective, we have somebody who is on a lower rung of social status because she's a woman. It's just how it was. I'm not saying how it should be. She's a Samaritan, which from a Jewish context means you're supposed to basically hate her. And she's had a hard life. And in an honor-shame type culture, it would have been deeply shameful for her, even though it all kind of happened to her, which is, again, really unfortunate. This is somebody who is on the lowest of the low in terms of cultural status. Now, when Jesus reveals that he knows some things about her, we see something very profound shift. And this is something that happens in all of the gospel writers, where the people who should not get it, and the people who should get it, don't. Because she immediately says, "Oh, you're a prophet." This is not a common moment for people. People don't see Jesus healing people and then say, and then they say, "Oh, you must be a prophet. You must be the Son of God." And usually they're just like, "Hey, great, awesome, thank you. Glory to God. Who is that guy, by the way?" But she says, "Wait, you're at least a prophet. What's going on here?" And then when she realizes that, she says, she basically says, if I can translate through the culture, "Okay, I got a question for you." Which is why sometimes I admit, especially when I'm tired, if I'm like on a plane and somebody asks me what I do, especially if I'm really tired, it's like, I'm a software engineer, because nobody ever has a follow-up question. But if you say, "I'm a pastor," it's like, "Well," it's like, "Oh, here we go." I mean, I'm happy to have those conversations, just not when I'm tired and grumpy on a plane. But anyway, she says, "Our people say God is to be worshipped here on Mount Gerizim. And that's where their temple was. And for them, that's where God dwelled." And then she said, "But you Jewish people, you say that God should be worshipped and is therefore present in Jerusalem on Mount Zion." Her question essentially is, since you're a prophet, which is it? And then Jesus says, "The time is coming." And then later he says, is now here. "When the true worshipers of God will worship in spirit and truth." Now, just like with Nicodemus, that water and spirit, it's the same construction. It's, again, if you're ever on Jeopardy, it's a really weird kind of Jeopardy. It's called a hendiadys. It equates those two things. And so a better translation would be, the true worshipers of God will worship God in spirit, which is the true way to worship. And this is incredibly radical for that moment, because what he's saying is that God is not bound by location, which is not something a first century person would understand. But rather, God is about to cast out or send out his people as the true temples to bring, bear, cultivate the presence of God everywhere they go. That is ultimately the Christian message. We are the presence of God wherever we are. And then we see really the genius and wisdom of this woman. Because she then says, when the Messiah comes, he's going to say things like this. Nobody else really gets that. But she does. And then Jesus honors her and says, "That's me. So if we're keeping score, we have, best I can tell, basically the lowest of the low of the social status, who for reasons, complicated cultural reasons, is the recipient of tremendous shame, understanding and receiving the most important truth of all time. And not only that, prior to Jesus being raised from the dead, she is one of a tiny number of people who get that. Now, we could spend all kinds of time just going through with a fine-tooth comb this whole interaction, but she ends up going off to her village. In other words, the people who would have placed that shame on her, and essentially says, I've found somebody very special. I think he's actually the one we've been waiting for. That would make her, by the way, an apostle. That's what that's called. She becomes one of the first missionaries. And she's the absolute wrong person to do that if you are trying to abide by cultural standards. So first I would ask you, who's your Samaritan? Who don't you like? Don't answer, but who don't you like? Please, it'd be so weird. Especially if it's like, but they're right over there. Why would you say that? Who don't you like? Who do you see as the lower status? Or the lowest status? This could be a group of people. You're Republican, Democrats, Republicans, whatever. Those people over there who should be doing things like this. That person specifically whom I name, who I really just don't like, or we've had words, or whatever. All of us have somebody like that in our lives. Reimagine that story of Jesus and this woman, but swap those out. How does that story sound now? It should sound uncomfortable. Because the gospel is uncomfortable. And secondly, the entire history of our people, followers of Jesus, is filled with moments of our spiritual ancestors and our spiritual brothers and sisters today and here finding their Samaritans and loving them regardless. As we move into Commitment Sunday next week and we talk a little bit more about some specific things that are both have happened, are happening, and will happen in our community as Christ Lutheran Church and School. And there are lots of reasons to be excited. We would be a complete failure, and we would be absolutely wasting our time if we were not actively finding our Samaritans and loving our neighbors and changing our community and therefore the world in that process. That if Jesus is willing to sit down with the absolute wrong person who by a series of, just by sheer probability, mistakes and sins, but also a system that has just kind of held her down, who then comes to understand who Jesus is in a very deep and profound way, that if that is our story, then we have to first remember that we are that person sitting in that well talking with Jesus, and we are first and foremost the wrong person. And in recognizing who Jesus is, being given that gift of faith, we've become something different. And we would be absolutely wasting our time if we then did not turn around and do the same to those around us. To love our neighbor, care for those around us, change our community, and therefore the world. Amen.